Well, now we move from decent music to the theme song of Bathrop Spears' Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3. It's the September 17, 2000 show, and I want to thank Vinny for carrying on in the last hour and how he carries on, but stay with us for some real carryings on for the next 2.5 hours with civil rights all over Santa Cruz, particularly on your block and outside your house or outside your squat, as the case may be. Again to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the twice weekly civil rights show on Free Radio. There certainly are other ones, but this is the one I host. My name is Robert Norse, or Bathrop Spear, as I sometimes style myself. This is 2.5 hours coming at you, and we talk about criminalization of poor people and hopefully the way to decriminalize poor people. And those of us, that includes people in houses and out of houses, in apartments, in ADUs, accessory dwelling units that may well be next up on the city's hit list, with current Title 4 coming up at the city council meeting a week from Tuesday. And I want to sound the warning on that. You heard Fred Geiger talking about that issue in a couple of past shows. He talked about one or two aspects of it, and I hope others are going to talk about other aspects of that complete revamping of the building inspection process that allows essentially, as I understand it, the whole city to become a free fire zone for building inspectors, and yet provides no guarantee that any of the ADUs will be granted in. That is to say that the garages that are being used as housing will be allowed to exist if they're brought up to code, other than such things as unrealistic requirements that there be a covered parking area for the house and that there be a setback of 5 feet from the property line. These are the two concerns that Geiger raised. I've also got other concerns about this massive increase in city power for building inspectors, which I fear may be used for political purposes rather than to safeguard the rights of tenants, which I would like to see happen. It's just it's important, I guess, for us to get an understanding of how that process has worked in the Beach Flats, where for I guess a decade or so, or nearly a decade, Linda Garner has been the building inspector person who's had the power to kind of move in and target so-called substandard housing. And I guess there are arguments both ways on that. I actually had long conversations with Linda Garner around the Dolphin and the Lee apartments this spring to understand her process and how she works, and she was very patient with me and gave me lots of interesting information, and hopefully we can discuss further the concerns that some of us have that political power, if expanded to the city, may be used to go after units that don't look as pretty as West Side upscale units, and can then be used to kick people out and condemn buildings so that new, fancier, more upscale buildings can be built. more residents is sort of like what I call the Pelton Street palaces that displaced the homeless garden project 2 years ago. I could be completely shooting, you know, in the dark and hitting in the wrong direction, but I'd like to hear some discussion about this. And indeed, that's coming up in 2 weeks, a major revision of an expansion of city police powers for the building code inspectors, new building inspectors, and no protection as of yet for ADUs, which is, I understand, 1 to 2,000 units in the city, which would, I think, result in potentially massive homelessness if the planning department, or those who are in the building, doing the building inspection, start inspecting and condemning and requiring impossible demands of those who are currently renting out those units. And I don't know what that situation is entirely, so I'm inviting folks to call in at 427-3772 and talk about that situation. I'm going to be talking about that. We're also hopefully going to be getting a call from Deanna, who's a homeless woman who has found employment. She was homeless for a couple of years, and she's now a regular person in a regular office in terms of how she looks to the rest of us. And I'd like to get her experiences. We hope she'll be able to call in. We've also invited candidate Bonnie Moore to call in, although we don't know if we're going to catch her. And we're going to have an update on the homeless working groups analysis of at least the 10 candidates we've had so far. I should say it's not really an official analysis. We have another 5 or 6 candidates to go. I think we actually had 9 candidates or 8 candidates who've been able to make it to the 2 homeless working group Friday afternoon forums at the Holiday Inn, and there will be another such forum coming up on next Friday at 3 o'clock at the Holiday Inn, which is on Ocean Avenue or Ocean Street at the Chamber of Commerce office. Now, not really a forum in the sense that everybody sits back and asks questions from a distance. It's more of an informal discussion and colloquy, but some of us are putting some real clear questions to the candidates. We had 3 kind of primary litmus test questions, which I know Huff has, wants to know about, and it's not strictly a Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom forum, but it's a homeless working group forum, which is a group that formed to try to press for safe sleeping places and to do something when the city council completely dropped the ball this summer, refusing both to establish safe sleeping zones and to put any issue on the ballot about decriminalization of sleep. And we're now going to the city and going to the county trying to press them to do something fast, and as well as demanding of candidates that they take a position on the issue. And so we're going to be talking. I'm going to give some of my impressions of the candidates, and this is by no means an official homeless working group impression. They'll have to make their own decisions. And Huff hasn't endorsed any of the candidates yet and has set up kind of tentatively 3 litmus tests for the candidates. One is, do you favor striking A and B of the camping ordinance, which is the sleeping ban and the blanket ban, which makes it illegal to sleep in public after 11 o'clock at night, or actually on a lot of private property too. It's a sleeping ban rather than a camping ban. We've been trying to eliminate that for years, saying, okay, go after people for camping. That's stupid, considering there's no affordable housing, but for 1 to 2,000 people in the city limits. But if you're going to go after anything, go after people who are actually camping, establishing permanent campsites, setting up tents, having camping equipment, rather than people who fall asleep, because you can't. It's a human rights violation to do that. Second thing is the blanket ban makes it illegal for people to have a blanket, even if they're not asleep, after 11 o'clock at night in such a fashion that it can be readily used for sleeping. That is, like, it's draped over you. That hasn't been enforced much in the last 3 or 4 years because it's so notorious, but it's still there for the police to use. We want to eliminate that. We're asking that the candidates agree to strike A and B of the camping ordinance, which would mean the sleeping ban and the blanket ban, and would be done immediately after the elections, so that even if there's a month lead time, as there is with ordinances that are passed without a supermajority of 5-2 as urgency ordinances, that is to say ordinances that go through the usual process, even if there is that longer time, that the ordinance would go into effect by Christmas, which means that the council would have to have special sessions and it would have to act very quickly. And so far, we seem to have gotten the consent of Steve Argue and Scott Bugenthal, though there's some dispute about that. Some say that Scott is also hedging that on safe zones, and maybe we can get our producer to have Scott call in to once more reassure at least the free radio listening audience that he means decriminalizing sleep, whether or not they find those special safe zones or not, which are so elusive. You know, that is to say, there's always somebody objecting somewhere, and that's being used by the city council people to say, oh, well, can't do anything, sorry, we'll study the issue for another 2 years or another 5 years or wait till the next council or just won't talk about it at all. So that was one of the litmus tests, strike A and B. And I also added to that, I think we should ask the city council candidates to bring up their position at every council forum when homelessness comes up as an issue, so that they aren't just telling one section of the electorate, those that want to hear it, the homeless, pro-homeless rights groups, that they will end the sleeping ban. But so they're telling everybody in the community. And this does a couple of things. First, it educates the community. It puts the community in a position where they can talk back and say, we don't want those damn homeless sleeping in our neighborhoods. And a dialogue is established whereby the myths are cleared away, the bigotry is revealed, and the whole issue is frankly and fairly and fully discussed in such a way that it hasn't really been before. We haven't had a real discussion process with the opponents. The opponents have emailed the hell out of city council and come in and made a few sharp speeches and backed off, saying that they felt intimidated by the pro-homeless rights folks at the forums. So we need to have the candidates really defending these positions, not just to the people who agree with them, but to the people who don't agree with them. That is very important, I think, and that's why I'm asking every candidate who says they're going to pass the sleeping ban repeal after they get into office to say so before audiences where it's not politic to do so. And I know this is sort of counter to the normal campaigning spirit where you're supposed to go out there and win, 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 and say A to group A, B to group B, and try to then mesh the two faces later. That's the kind of stuff I don't want to see. I don't trust candidates who do that, which means I don't trust 95% of the candidates, I suppose, on the American scene. But still, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for them to go and raise that same issue at every single candidate forum. I would like them to see them raise it, period, even if the homeless issue isn't raised. But certainly if the homeless issue comes up, they say, and the first thing I want to say is I've committed myself to striking A and B of the sleeping ban. And I'm saying that because we need to do that. We also need all kinds of other things. We need services. We need safe places to sleep. We need maybe, as Arnie Leff proposed, a joint county-city power group, although, you know, the county is, I think, more likely to cause trouble and bog everything down than to get anywhere, based on what Marty Wormhout and her coterie has done and not done in the last decade around homeless issues. But we want to see that sleeping ban raised at every forum, every forum. If you're going to do it, then you bring it to the community and you discuss it. And if you're going to try to do it before Christmas, you're going to have to bring it to the community, or they're going to demand extensive hearings yet again. We have an incoming call here, and I'll tell you about the other two litmus tests as soon as we move on from this call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I don't want to miss your litmus test.
Oh, certainly not. Well, I can tell you on the phone if you want.
Go ahead, Robert, please.
Well, the other two litmus tests are rent control and renter protection, which means actually it's kind of a more compound kind of litmus test. It says, do you favor rent control, real rent control, and action, not just talk on rent control immediately? Do you favor renter protection, such as stopping evictions without just cause? And do you favor around the Dolphin property, which is the biggest so-called affordable, or I should say low-income housing project that the city is now prepared to dump $12 million into, guarantees for the tenants, the current tenants of that property, that they will not lose their lodging without getting an assured place in the new lodging, the new so-called Mercy Charities housing property. That's the second one. That's kind of a compound question, as I said. And the third one has to do with real community control of police. And, of course, it's a little vague, but we kind of have been playing with that, trying to suggest that we want, at the far end of it is the firing of the police chief, so you get a new police chief. I should say the re-examination of the police chief and getting some new blood in there, retiring, let's say, not retiring rather than firing. But certainly, even if you don't want to do that, you don't want to send him out of town on the next train, which isn't such a bad idea. Nonetheless, you might want to do things like establish a police commission with disciplinary and prosecutorial powers, which, by the way, is not the case in any city in this country yet, so it would be a groundbreaking move. And you want to make sure, you want to open up independent investigations by having a legal counsel that doesn't involve a conflict of interest or isn't a sort of an imported feel-good guy, like I'm afraid Bob Aronson to some extent is. He's the counsel of the CPRB, as the Citizens Police Review Board is imported. So the third question fundamentally is community control of police, real community control of police, real examination of lethal force standards, real examination of the bloated police budget. And I'm having trouble distilling that down to a very specific question, but that's kind of what I was talking about.
Well, in virtually every case, whether I agree with you or not, specifically, it takes principle and courage and forthrightness to come forth rather than dodge around. And just for example, the CPRB, they inherently have the power to proclaim. I don't think they have ever used it in its existence. They have used that power to proclaim essentially to look the other way and play duck and cover have their little power trip. And to me, these are the crucial issues. There's this whole trip with we and power. Why isn't anyone speaking out about rent control? That's the reason why there isn't a bandwagon. And to me, this is the important issue. And I don't think you will see anyone that perceives they have a chance to be elected to take on any serious issues.
Perhaps with
that's politics in the year 2000. I do want to mention that Joe Rodriguez in the Merc has another excellent rent control article in today's San Jose Mercury News.
And you can, I think, get that Mercury News article online, too. Mercury News is online for those of you who have computers and don't want to spend, I don't know, $1.50 on the Sunday Mercury News with all its classified. So
there's a good archives of Joe Rodriguez's stories on rent control going back to June on the Merc online. In fact, next time I call, I'll have the Merc online URL for you. But yeah, if you just type in San Jose Mercury and columnist Joe Rodriguez, he's been doing very strong positive rent control articles going back to June.
Mm-hmm.
And this latest one is about, he uses the example of rent gouging.
Mm-hmm.
A woman has her rent jacked up 100%. And without rent control, meaningful rent control, there's nothing that she can do.
She gets
evicted.
What about a tax on housing speculation, too, on holding housing vacant for long periods of time?
Personally, I wouldn't favor that. I know these things are kind of intertwined. You hear things and you wonder, like real estate development on a major level in big cities like San Francisco, when they moved the ballpark downtown to China Basin,
mm-hmm.
that just skyrocketed real estate prices all around there.
Mm-hmm.
Major. They put in a big freeway dump to that area. So there was a lot of, for lack of a better term, collusion between mm-hmm. public and private, and Willie Brown's cronies or whoever cronies are on the inside track to benefit from these kinds of things. So granted, I still will come back to rent control and say that such a basic human need as housing deserves to be removed from the vulgarity mm-hmm. of the unbridled market.
Well, I hope you raise these issues if and when you ever put your feet in the cesspool of these council candidate forums.
Yeah, that's a good point. One other thing I want to say. To me, we are individuals in a community politically is when we deal with what's the issue and who's the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
When we start talking about this we stuff, you know, we SCAN members, we Green Party affiliates.
We Chamber of Commerce.
Right,
folks.
Okay. It's the goon squad for power.
Mm-hmm.
And you look the other way at the obvious double standards in your own camp and justify all kinds of stuff.
What about the ADUs? Let me ask you about that, Bob.
The ADU?
What about the idea of grandfathering in existing ADUs as, at least insofar as not finding them illegal if they are closer than 5 feet to the property line or they don't have a covered outdoor parking for the main house?
I think these things are all up for question. I would put into this that the whole permit process, the reason why you don't have beatniks in Greenwich Village is partially because permits. Permits began to become imposed on housing codes. So the codes is what we're talking about here, the building codes.
Mm-hmm.
I think these things are up for question. Certainly, I heard Fred's call, by the way, last Thursday, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Santa Cruz needs to embrace density. I don't think there's any question about it. What follows a green belt in the instance of Santa Cruz, California, in my opinion and others, is density.
And you mean allowing houses to be built in a more dense way?
Oh, totally.
Mm-hmm.
Granny units. It's interesting when you look at Monterey. Monterey's had granny units for 20 years or more.
Mm-hmm. And how has that affected the community?
I think it's still a very attractive, clean area
mm-hmm.
in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
All right? It still has that look of a small town. I can see where one would want to constrain things, but I think we also need to look at the reality. There has to be some growth. The question is how one controls it, how one limits it.
Mm-hmm.
But growth is going to happen.
We'll have to have you and Keith Sugars squaring off on this issue, perhaps.
I'd be more than happy to. On this issue and on the general issue of the power to proclaim and coming forth before things are bandwagons.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know what is. He may actually support your position on this issue.
He may well.
You know, although he certainly hasn't spoken up in any strong leadership way for it. That's for sure.
I don't see it, Robert. I'm sorry.
Right. Well, it's okay. I think the more of us who raise the question at these forums, the more nervous the candidates get unless they say something about it.
You're right on. You're right on. Once again, Joe Rodriguez, San Jose Mercury News, profound, continual statements, positive regarding rent control.
Well, I appreciate the call. Is there anything else you want to say here?
Thanks a lot, Robert. Thank you much.
Thank you,
all
Bob.
Right. You bet. Bye.
Bye.
Phone lines are open here at Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM at 427-3772. If you're a little shy about going on the air but want to talk to the producer of the show, the number is 423-HUFF, 423-4833. If you want to leave a message for Free Radio on other subjects, such as you might have some loop tape you want to pass on, some news, a financial donation, dare I think it, a demo tape, give a call to 427-4523 or send it to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Webpage for Santa Cruz, and we do, as I understand, stream on the net, is www.microradio.net/FRSC. And if you want to email us, we are at frsc@microradio.net or frsc@cruzio.com. And again, the call-in number here is 427-3772. We do have a line in. That's our only line, so use it if you'd like. And if you want to pick up any of this information and say I've got it, given it to you too quickly, haven't got a pencil, 423-HUFF should give you some of it. And you can call 423-HUFF between show times. If you want to be on this show, if you have some criticism or some addition or some commendations for what we've said on the air, 423-4833. It's just the phone number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Well, we're going to begin today's show with a look back at Los Angeles. And that is was quite a scene about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago now, with the Democratic National Coronation, or Convention as they like to call it, when Gore and Lieberman were hailed as the new Führers for a new era. It looks like they may well be the elected candidates, what with Bush stumbling all over himself. And some people think this is great cause for rejoicing, but those of us outside thought it wasn't particularly. Neither of the candidates have any significant differences on very meaningful issues that really have to be addressed, ranging from campaign financing to corporate control of media to defense policy. And, of course, with respect to the homeless, though you might hear Tipper Gore talking about the homeless and while she's off to censor the records with another breath, and you may hear Bush's dad talking about 1,000 points of light. You don't see meaningful proposals around decriminalizing homeless people or massive attempts to change the affordable housing famine from either side that I can see. And of course, anybody who's a fan of Bush or Gore, feel free to call in and correct me on this stuff. So the real issue is a third-party candidate like Nader, who is actually raising the issues, though he's being blacked out by the media largely, with an interesting exception. Friday or Saturday, the San Francisco Examiner had three stories, one all on the front page, side by side, of equal length, about Bush, Gore, and Nader. I thought that was, I wish that were a harbinger for what's to come. It's certainly a pleasant thing to see. Anyway, the Democratic National Coronation was a time of great protest, and also there was massive police presence down there, frighteningly so, almost a sort of a terroristic presence. And we're going to be listening to a tape in a moment after we take this call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Just a quick comment. Just wanted to let listeners know that there is a fourth and fifth and sixth party presidential candidates, and one of those tickets is two women. For the Workers' World Party, I believe they're on the ballot in at least 25 states, mm-hmm. and their names are Monica Moorhead, who is running for president, and Gloria LaRiva, who is also on her ticket, and she's the vice presidential candidate. And Gloria LaRiva, of course, ran for governor on the Peace and Freedom Party a few years back. Mm-hmm. Peace and Freedom Party lost their ballot status, unfortunately, in this state. So they ran on the Workers' World ticket, and that's just I just want to throw that out there because I do hear what you're saying about Nader not getting as much presidential coverage in the mainstream press, but there's two names I have not heard at all mentioned, even on free radio.
Well, let's not forget Pat Buchanan, man.
No, well, I don't want to even talk about that guy.
Perhaps we should forget Pat Buchanan.
I'm talking about Monica Moorhead and Gloria Larivas. So I want to let listeners know there's other choices out there,
Sure, and if you want to call in with more specifics about their planks, feel free to do so.
Okay, I'll do that. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And indeed, there's also the Natural Law Party, and there's a couple of other parties, some of whom have probably much better planks than the main party, the main two-headed party, the Demo-Republicans or the Republicrats, whatever you want to call them, the fat cat boys, and mostly boys, who are running the country and running it into the ground and, burning up the ozone layer and melting. I guess I heard the North Pole is now down 20%, turning into mush. Thank you very much. That's not, homeless Santa Cruz news strictly, but it means all of us was maybe swimming around in another century with no Santa Cruz at all if the oceans rise 100 feet or 20 feet. I don't know. So please give a call if you have any thoughts on civil rights issues for the poor. What we're doing today is we're going to be running through this L.A. a retrospective a bit. You're going to hear some interviews that I did down there, and you're going to then we'll be getting into more local things like the latest homeless working group grilling of some of the council candidates, not because we think you should jump on the bandwagon of any of these council candidates, with the possible exception of Steve Argue, but not because I think you should. I mean, certainly you can make up your own mind, but because the debate, as I was telling the last caller, or the caller before the last, really is the issue. If we can raise these issues strongly enough and get the public interested in these issues, the candidates, one way or another, will have to address them, and indeed some of them will probably take action to propose them if and when they get to city council. So that is the reason why I go for the local issues, but now let's look at L.A.
Arch criminal, what's your name?
My street name would be Hayduke.
Hayduke?
Hayduke, like George Hayduke from Ed Abbey.
Again, you're dealing with a cultural idiot, so we won't even talk about that.
Okay.
Hayduke. So, Hayduke, you were actually probably not far from where I was last night, outside the Staples Center at the... I guess you were outside the center at the corner?
Right, at the protest pit where the concert...
You were I was further away. I was at this the first public... the road intersection right near that, and they began beating people there without any warning. But you said, what happened in the protest center? Give
us
the details.
In the protest pit, we had watched or listened to the concert and watched a few people get a little rowdy at the fence, throwing junk over.
Right.
And then they had given us the 15 minutes to disperse order, and I waited, and I looked at the watch because I wanted to make sure I don't want to be arrested.
Right.
So after 10 minutes, I said, okay, it's time. So I started leaving, went out to, I believe it's Olympic Boulevard.
That's where I was.
And they had told us to disperse up Figueroa. And that was all blocked off by cops. And I was like, oh, great. So I head out onto Olympic, and I hear the bang, bang, bang of what sound like shotguns shooting their beanbags and rubber bullets. So at that point, started walking a lot quicker, and I got hit in the back of the thigh by a rubber bullet as we were dispersing. And nobody was confronting the cops at that point. We were all leaving.
Now, did the police approach you with batons or anything?
No, they were just holding their line, shooting indiscriminately into the crowd as we were dispersing.
Now, they were shooting up the street that the protest originally came up, or the perpendicular street?
They were shooting up the street parallel to the Staples Center. And that's
the one the protests originally arrived from.
I'm sorry?
The one the protests originally arrived from?
Yeah, we were going further down the street towards the...
In other words, the protest was coming down the way you would come up in the old days.
Right. Well, as a march had come in on Olympic, I believe...
And you were leaving. Continued,
yeah, we were definitely leaving.
Right. Did you see any other untoward behavior by our guardians in blue?
Just... one guy who had climbed up onto the fence, up onto the top of the fence. He's halfway.
Staples.
Climbing over the security fence towards Staples. He was just, they were just lighting him up with the pepper spray bullets. And I mean, just boom, 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 boom. He must have got hit by at least 40, 50 of the pepper spray bullets. They came over with their little pepper gas canisters and sprayed him a few times to get him off the fence. And he just hung there, man. And then he finally made it onto the top of it and sat down. And the crowd was really getting upset that the police were, you know, just attacking him with all these chemical weapons.
Was this on the back fence or the front fence?
The back. This was the back fence.
So the police did make it to that back area.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of police on the other side of it.
I see.
The police weren't on the protest side.
I see.
And, you know, when he got to the top, it's like, okay, if he goes down on your side, arrest him. Don't torture him and light him up with all this chemical garbage.
Well, it's sort of an experiment. How much can a human being stand? It's a brave new world.
And then his friends who were handing bottles of water up to him, they're getting, you know, hit by the bullets as well, the pepper bullets. And they're just trying to help their friend with water. They weren't, you know, handing him anything to throw at the officer.
They were shouting, this is what the police state looks like?
Pretty much, yeah.
Were they engaging?
This is what democracy looks like in a police state.
And what did police, were police being assaulted with rocks or bottles?
There were rocks and bottles being thrown over the fence. And the guys who were on top of the fence were not throwing anything. You know, they were just waving their flags up there. And, you know, if they had thrown something, then, hey, they deserve to, you know, get what they get. You know, less than lethal force, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, they weren't throwing nothing when they were on the fence. And if they go down the other side, duh, you're going to get arrested.
Right.
And there was stuff being thrown over the fence, which I was opposed to, but, you know, that's somebody else's tactics and what have you. And those who were throwing, they were getting hit by stuff, too.
It all worked out nicely. I can see that. Any other comments? Did you get your injury treated? Did you make a complaint?
No, wasn't that bad. Just a shot in the back of the thigh and a little bruise. And it'll go away.
Well, thank you. Anything you want to add for Free Radio Santa Cruz?
Just for the Free Radio Santa Cruz?
Mm-hmm.
Just Free Radio Fresno. I'll be back on there soon.
It's about time, Fresno. Get it busy.
And there you have it, another broadcast report, I should say, delayed but still reaching you, about another view of the Monday police riot, or I should say disciplined police terrorism against legitimate First Amendment-protected protesters at the Los Angeles Democratic coronation. And it was quite something. Becky Johnson, got my producer and a video journalist down there, got hit by the police, and she is indeed suing them through a sympathetic lawyer in Los Angeles. We'll see if that goes anywhere and how many years it takes. But it's certainly indisputable that police brutalized scores of people, indeed, including reporters, targeting reporters. There's an ACLU suit against not just reporters and delegates who were casually hit, but reporters who were actually targeted for taking tape and being on the scene. And after they identified themselves as reporters, being hit again, it's quite clear the LAPD is not only out of control, but the city council down there is justifying it. We've heard no protests from them. We've heard no call for an investigation. So the only time that you get the thing like the Rampart investigation, or the investigation of the police Rampart station, which has been a huge burgeoning scandal, which will cost the city millions, if not billions, of dollars. Probably millions, I'm not quite sure the orders of magnitude, is when people inside the department, for one reason or another, expose what goes on, and then the city has to react because it is so embarrassed and because the lawsuits start to flow. And indeed, lawsuits is the next thing I want to talk about here in Santa Cruz. On September 11th, I filed a lawsuit with the help of Robert and Eleanor, two fine activists. Eleanor is severely disabled, but you can't stop her. She's spoken before at city council meetings and talks on the air quite regularly on this show. A lawsuit concerning Brown Act violations, and I know that I've mentioned this on the air before, but I kind of want to tell all of you out there who don't have any clear sense of what this really means, how I see it. For the last 2 years, the city council, though elected by a landslide, three of them, in 1998, on a platform of decriminalizing, with the promise to decriminalize homelessness and to end the sleeping ban, have refused to bring up the issue publicly in any meaningful way. They've kind of let themselves be second-guessed and led and bullied and cover the ass of Catherine Byers, who suddenly decided to shift to the right after the election. She'd previously, we thought, was going to lead the progressive bloc. Nope, she decided to lead the other bloc. And yet the three new council members, Fitzmaurice, Cronin, Sugar, were so determined or hopeful or pathetically eager to keep her support for votes that they would actually punish activists like myself for exposing Byers's abusive behavior, abusive in a number of ways, and that homeless people were getting beaten up, and Byers was continuing to refuse to allow, she blocked the proposal for decriminalizing sleeping in 1998-99. She delayed it, first of all, when the council candidates wanted to bring it up initially and get it out of the way after that first Christmas after the 1998 elections. She wouldn't allow that. She held 3 months of a sideshow hearings called the Task Force to Examine the Camping Ordinance, and then decided unilaterally she wouldn't even allow a discussion of the sleeping ban per se. She just decided, well, I can't vote for it because I've heard from certain influential community groups that they don't like it, talking about people like the Downtown Neighbors, perhaps, or the Harvey West Association, who were nervous about, she had talked about an examination of the entire camping ordinance, which is a much broader thing, and actually put fear into the hearts of some of the right-wingers in the community that would be a good thing at some time, but initially we just wanted the sleeping ban looked at, that portion of the camping ban that criminalizes the act of sleeping, not the part that says you can put up tents and so forth and regulates or actually bans all camping, which is also absurd, but that wasn't what we were looking at that moment, what we had asked for. So she was able, in essence, in a backhanded way, to mobilize the community with its fear of ending the camping ban to attack the entire sleeping, to attack that part of the camping ban, which was the sleeping ban. And as a consequence, she then used that as justification for turning around saying, I won't vote for it, and Cronin Sugar, shut down as well, although in the final votes they tried to propose some amendments, but they didn't lead on them publicly. They didn't educate the public, and it went nowhere. And then for a year, they, in essence, did nothing while police were beating on some homeless people, troll busters were beating on other ones, and the whole situation meant no legal place to sleep for 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people in Santa Cruz, with the exception of, for 8 months of the year, 28 floor spaces for 28 people in the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program. They also created this group called the Homeless Issues Task Force, which was kind of a trade-off for Christopher Crone. Catherine Byers saying, well, we won't do anything, but we'll let you talk about it for another year in this little group. Well, the little group turned out to have a will of its own for a while and immediately asked that the entire camping ordinance be repealed, rent control be established, that the city attorney be forced to institute the small legal changes that Catherine Byers did allow to pass in the spring of 1999, like lowering the fine, but the city attorney didn't inform the courts about it for 4 months, so the fine wasn't lowered until some of us independent activists through the Homeless Issues Task Force pushed to have that done. And even then, Byers continued to delay any Homeless Issues Task Force reports, not allow them to be put on the agenda, not allow them to put on as attachments. And the Homeless Issues Task Force got increasingly frustrated and upset, and when Sugar became mayor, and we hoped there'd be a new deal in the fall of 1999, we went to Sugar and we said, look, time to take some action before Christmas. Let's end the sleeping ban, or let's at least raise it as a vote. Byers can be pressured, because the issue is really a quite simple moral one and a common sense one. You can't arrest people for sleeping when there are no legal places to sleep. And there also have been two initiatives, David Silva's sleeping ban initiative. I should say a lot of us did this. David did a lot of work. I did a lot of work. A lot of other people, including Becky Johnson and a whole bunch of people did a lot of work. Bernard Klitzner, Maureen Smith, a lot of folks working on these two initiatives, which essentially said, decriminalize sleeping completely. Sleeping should no longer be a crime, but also set up zones in the city so that if you find people in the wrong zones, you don't give them a ticket for sleeping. You give them a ticket for not moving to the so-called safe sleeping zones, which means safe from police harassment, not necessarily safe from troll busters. But if homeless people are allowed to sleep in groups, they're more likely to be able to protect each other. And if they can sleep in well-lighted areas with a police patrol, and where it's legal for them to be, they are more likely to be able to, secure, more secure from harassment, by beatings, by folks, bigots. And also they can use the facilities of the police. If they're beaten, they don't have to worry about sleeping tickets and sleeping warrants. They can actually go say, hey, I got beaten up, and they can call the police, whereas now that's problematic and has been for decades. So that was the reason that this initiative was proposed by David Silva, two of them, proposed by all of us. And we got thousands of registered voters in the city to sign those initiatives, but they never passed. We didn't get enough people to sign on the ballots. We didn't have the organization. We had problems with the weather in terms of the El Nino a couple years ago, and more recently other problems. But the point was that these issues have been fully debated, and many, many thousands of people, several thousands of people in the city had already signed on to them. And Sugar, when he came on, refused the Homeless Issue Task Force's emergency resolution to put the issue on the agenda in December. And he didn't. And he said, well, we'll have a report in January, and we can talk about oral communications. He broke his word on that. In January, the city council just sort of nodded when the Homeless Issues Task Force got up there and presented its midterm report. And eventually what happened was you had a situation where the mayor did nothing around these issues, and the city council did nothing until massive protests, both from Huff, whether it was the pie throwing or the sort of lie down at city council, and David Silva's fasts and the fasts of dozens, scores of others of people, kind of progressive fast, where they went from no meal, from one meal a day, two meals a day, then to one meal a day, then to water a day, some of them. There was that kind of pressure finally, and also sitting in on the city council offices where we would sit there from 9 to 5 asking to see council members. That finally got Sugar off his duff. But he wouldn't meet with the activists. He instead met with only one activist, David Silva, in any consistent way. I think he pulled Emily Riley into that group, but Emily Riley, it turned out, hadn't even read the camping ordinance. You know, and she had her own ideas, but nobody, only Silva really knew what was going on. They got promises from the police department that were broken. They delayed and stalled on the issue. Instead of, they did a first reading on a very small safe zones proposal, didn't bring it back at the next council meeting when they could have, June 6th. They didn't bring it back again on June 13th. Then only brought it back on June 27th, which brings us to this lawsuit, and that's my tangled web of getting there. This lawsuit talks about this process, and I give you that history because you have to understand the context in which this all happened. It's not that we're really picking on some what seemed to be kind of picayune things that the mayor did, maybe some of them less picayune than others, at the June 27th City Council meeting. And the reason that they're important is because of the entire history of delay and also the history of false arrests. James Ney was arrested in April by the mayor, targeted beforehand for arrest. He wasn't charged with anything. He was just taken out of the chambers when he told the mayor that he was ending oral communications early and demanded that oral communications be allowed to continue. He was thrown back by cops. 22 of them were in the back room. I think three or four came out. And he was held for an hour and a half or so in the back room and then released, again, breaking up the protest. Completely illegitimate behavior. I was told I couldn't bring in a porta-potty, a little kind of commode, a 5 or 10 pound gold-painted commode, which would have been a little prop for a skit as recently as July 25th when I was trying to raise the issue of the sleeping ban. Sugar has taken an increasingly authoritarian and really unconstitutional position on allowing even public comment or testimony. And it's been, he hasn't responded to attempts to mediate the issue through intermediaries like Don Burke. He hasn't responded to letters. He hasn't responded to phone calls. He's going to do what he wants. And therefore, the avenue to deal with this was the courts. And the first thing I did was I filed a letter on July 27th, which really was, I thought was the last day, but it turns out you have 3 months to deal with most of these violations. So that actually gave me more time, in which I protested. I specifically asked that there be, that I said that the Brown Act, the Public Meetings Act, had been violated in 5 ways. And the first way it was violated was that had to do with public comment at the, well, let me get, again, the background here is that very late at night on June 27th, actually in the early morning hours of June 28th, and we're going to play a little bit of that, they brought up this item that was supposed to be on the 3 o'clock agenda. It was actually communications from council members, and it was Christopher Crone who was bringing up 4 different things. First was use of the armory. They had hoped to be able to use the armory year-round. They just learned they couldn't. So what are they going to do about that? Talk some more about it. Thanks. The second thing they were going to bring up was, since they were all going to run like chickens from the safe sleeping zones because of emails from Plantronics and Texas Instruments, bigoted organizations in the area that were leading a hate campaign against them, as well as pressure from Supervisor Wormhout and vacillations from Catherine Byers, they were going to instead propose looking harder at finding parking lots in business areas and in churches, it's legal right now to sleep if you're in a vehicle in a business with the written permission of the owner in their parking lot, or in a church parking lot with the written permission of the church. So, but that hasn't been helpful, really. I mean, it's been helpful in a few cases, but generally it's not dealt with the issue of 1,000 to 2,000 people sleeping outside every night facing $54 tickets or beatings, or just general violation of their basic human rights. The fear they're going to be woken up at midnight, they can't get work because, I mean, they have to worry about going to work the next day at the same time dealing with no sleep, moving or being moved around by people like Lieutenant Habey, who we heard last time were running around Kathy and her partner in their van. So the problem was, so Krohn brought forward these four things. They were supposed to be on the 3 o'clock session. One of them was the armory. The other was the let's look again at these other zones, at these current zones. In essence, it's just let's talk about the current situation and not make any changes. The third was, and what would have been a change, to agendize for the next agenda in July the issue of the safe sleeping zones. And the fourth was to agendize for the next agenda, putting on the ballot the safe sleeping zones. Item 23.1A, and the recommendations were as follows from Christopher Krohn. Motion to direct the staff to redouble efforts in procuring safe and secure shelter for the homeless at the National Guard Armory at De La Vega Park. Well, you redouble efforts and you go nowhere, but that was with the first motion. Second motion, to direct staff to identify other suitable uses to house the homeless, which are not on city streets nor sidewalks, and to direct that staff report back to council within 30 days of these findings. And by the way, they didn't, so it's interesting. But again, it's talking about doing nothing fundamentally, making no expansion of safe areas. Three, a motion to direct the mayor to place on the July 11th council agenda the second reading of the ordinance amending Chapter 6.36, the Municipal Code, Ordinance 2010, to authorize overnight sleeping on public property or in vehicles on public streets in those areas of the city zoned for industrial use. This was the safe zones proposal that was originally passed for a first reading on May 23rd. And finally, a motion to direct the mayor to place a ballot measure on the July 11th council agenda regarding the amendment to the city's camping ban and to notify all interested persons and agencies of this pending action. And this was the proposal that David Silva had, was simply to put decriminalizing sleep on the ballot. Let's let the voters resolve it and talk about it. Forget the safe zones, talk about decriminalizing sleep and give the voters a chance to vote. These were the four motions that were originally on the 3 p.m. session and got moved up to about 12:45, 1 o'clock at night in the morning because of a packed agenda, because of the decision by the city council about its priorities. The homeless, of course, are last, as always. And that's what they did. So what happened here was the mayor allowed public comment on the first motion to procure the National Guard Armory, and on the third motion, which was to authorize the July 11th council agenda to put the safe sleeping zones on July 11th, but he didn't allow testimony on the other two items. This kind of differential treatment is a violation of the Brown Act. You have to allow it on each item that's voted on, each item that's agendized. That was our first... That's the first claim that I made, and you get to hear some of this on the tape. The second claim I made had to do with Catherine Byers. Catherine Byers decided that she would use the third item, which was Krohn saying, let's move this issue to July 11th and put it on the agenda so people can talk about it then. She said, no, I want to withdraw the entire ordinance now. And my claim is that that is not what is agendized here. That is a new thing. That is something different. And had that been on the agenda and had people known about it, there would have been a much greater crowd there to talk about the issue, even at 1 o'clock at night, if they had known she was going to kill the safe sleeping zones. But she acted, in essence, in violation of the Brown Act, because the Brown Act requires that these items for public interest be properly and clearly and accurately agendized. So that was my third point. The fourth point has to do with what Mayor Sugar did in terms of people who did try to speak on those items. And there were only three of us in the audience, Lydia Blanchard, Becky Johnson, and myself. Sugar repeatedly interrupted Johnson and me. And in so doing, he violated our right to public comment. You cannot interrupt people in the middle of their speeches and call it public comment. That's a form of harassment. It violates the Open Meetings Act. At least that's my claim. The fifth thing he did was he arrested me, had police called to the chamber, had me removed from the chamber. That is technically an arrest, or a detention, if you will, but I had to give my ID. I was removed from the chambers. I was also barred from the chambers, and I was barred from the next meeting for reminding him, admittedly from the floor, that he was interrupting people repeatedly, and that was a violation of the Brown Act. So those five items are the basis of this lawsuit, which was filed on September 11th. And the reason they were filed was I presented a letter to the mayor and to the city council on July 27th saying, please correct these violations. Now, the way they could have corrected those violations is they could have held a city council session or put this item on the next agenda and said, we are going to redo all the votes. We're going to let everybody have public comment. We're going to agendize the item properly so that people know that the safe sleeping zones are coming up for destruction and not be bushwhacked by Catherine Byers and Mike Rotkin. And instead of that, the city attorney said nothing. He didn't send me a letter that said, we won't do that. They just ignored it. Now, once that happens, a month later, it's my responsibility within 14 days as a Brown Act complainant, someone who says the Brown Act has been violated, to take the matter to court or just forget it. And so I was, you know, my resources were limited. I was not even sure I was going to pursue it any further. But Robert and Eleanor came forward and said, we want you to do this. And we actually got some people together to donate the $188 it requires to get this thing, you know, filed in the Superior Court. And Eleanor largely, almost entirely, wrote this rather impressive brief. We got some help from Ed Fry, too. But it was filed on September 11th. And that is the history of this first Brown Act set of violations. There's actually another Brown Act item that's included in there that was not something that specifically happened that night at the City Council, but it was something that you might say through omission, because they didn't do anything about it, was their responsibility. And that has to do with Mercy Charities Housing, which is the city's sole source low-income housing provider. They're the ones that have been given the deed to the Dolphin property. It actually hasn't been purchased yet, but they've been told they will be the managers without any competitive process. They are the people whose first preference requirements, whose requirements will essentially exclude many Dolphin people from coming in unless the city council demands it of them and unless it's guaranteed in law, and that's not happened yet, and we can't be sure it's going to happen, and so I'm saying it isn't happening because the council refuses to do that and because they specifically cut off negotiations with the Lee tenants when the Lee tenants in Residentes Unidos demanded that. Mercy Charities Housing is the city's sole source provider there, and they have been holding closed meetings of their advisory board since that board was created way back in January by city council resolution. Now, when the city council creates a board, even for a nonprofit that they don't control, when the city council funds that board through giving money to the Mercy Charities Housing, when the mayor of the city sits on that board as an official, and when he is a voting member, that constitutes Brown Act involvement. So it means that they have to hold open meetings with that board. And they have repeatedly refused to do that. Even though I've been to their meetings, they told me to leave. I did leave because I didn't want to be arrested. I did distributed my literature. I said, this is a violation of the Brown Act, what you're doing. And that was the additional point I raised in my lawsuit, is that the city council is allowing one of the boards that they fund, that they sit on publicly, to violate the law, the state law that says you have to hold open meetings. You have to let the public come into these board meetings and observe them and broadcast part of them, let's say, if for public information, as we often do here on Free Radio with city council meetings. So all these issues were brought forward and have been filed as a lawsuit. We've asked the city to redo all actions that the Mercy Charities Housing Board took for the last 8 months, because they are refusing, they're holding closed meetings, and because the council is refusing to control their creature, Mercy Charities Housing Advisory Board. They in essence are funding it, they are sitting on it where the mayor is a voting member, so they have a responsibility, and they're not meeting that responsibility. They're not meeting their responsibility, I think, as well, in letting people, even their critics, and I'm certainly a critic of what City Council has been doing around the sleeping ban and the Dolphin demolition plan, to speak up at City Council meetings and not be arrested, not be interrupted, not be cut off from the mic, as has happened repeatedly, And Mayor Sugar is just has shown himself intractable on this issue. Part of it, I suppose, is a personality thing. I'd say he's a type A personality, I'm a type A personality, but he's the mayor. He has a responsibility to set these things aside and maintain a fair treatment of everyone there. So these are a series of Brown Act violations which have gone to court. Now, we think we're going to amend this to include what essentially are 60 or more Brown Act violations which have been mentioned in subsequent letters. I wrote a letter on August 11th about what they did at the July 11th City Council meeting. I wrote a letter 2 weeks after that on what they did at the July 25th Council meeting. And I wrote another letter just 4 or 5 days ago, the same day I filed this writ of mandamus request. Writ of mandamus means we ask the court to require the city to do something, which is to redo all this stuff and to pay an attorney for any costs and to pay us for any costs that have been incurred in getting this. I filed this most recent letter actually going back 3 months, because I hadn't realized before I could go back 3 months, to even David Silva's arrest. You may remember activist David Silva, he calls it a kidnapping, I call it an arrest, was dragged off to the Nut House as he went up to the mic to try to support Dolphin and Lee tenants, and actually he represented the SCAN Housing and Homelessness Committee. He was the chair of that, and they had a resolution that said, stop this stupid project until you have, you know, real negotiations and guarantees with the tenants. We've got a call here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yes, I say it was kidnapping.
You do indeed. This is David Silva, right?
Yeah, that's right. They called me outside. I thought maybe they needed some help with some kind of disturbance or something out there. And so you come outside for a minute. So I came outside, and they put the handcuffs on me, and they took me into. Well, first they tried to get me to fall to the ground with that particular kind of hold they do with the
pain compliance hold.
Handcuffs, yeah, compliance hold. But I refused to fall. I didn't want to look like I was resisting arrest, which was they're trying to create that image. Interesting thing was, about a block and a half away, as I was in the back seat of the car, a motorcycle cop came up to the car and said, "Is there? Do you need any help? You need any help with this one? Anything you can do with this one?" And the guy says, "Oh no, this one's nobody. There's nobody following us. Don't worry, I got it under control. You know, he's completely disposable."
Well, I know that when you were taken away, there was a crowd of 30 or 40 people who followed along.
But nobody followed us about a block and a half away where that motorcycle cop joined him.
I see.
I don't know if this cop was actually trying to get the motorcycle cop to go away because he didn't want to murder me, and so he made this implication of me being disposable and just wanted to let the guy know that he knew what
to
do.
Sounds like he was just trying to derogate you.
If I had been a mental health patient, to be in the back seat and hear that you were going to be disposed of, you know, that you were disposable and they were taking you away, and they never told me what they were taking me away for. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I got to Dominican Hospital, and by that time I had already convinced the officer that he was being used as a political pawn in mm-hmm. this game.
Now the background of this, we got to be honest.
And the people at the hospital, you know, after they heard my story and the background on how this happened, they really, you know, were, you know, declared me, you know, one of the sanest men that they ever met, mm-hmm. and that they really wished that the police department and the city council would come in and have a checkup.
I think Sugar could use a little rest. There's no question about that. I know that this all stemmed from your utter frustration with the process of delay and backtracking that happened around the sleeping zones.
Wasn't
right?
Delay and backtracking as much as it's a complete betrayal. We had set up the safe sleeping zones operation, setting up operations group. And
that was the mayor's, that little kind of small clique that the mayor had led into that group.
Yeah, with the staff and mm-hmm. myself, and there was Emily Riley and Pat Clark were the public people in it. But it was mostly with the chief of police and staff. Mm-hmm. We went out to the industrial zones, and we saw how to make it work. Well, the police department kept on whittling it down and whittling it down and whittling it down and whittling it down till it got to such a tight area that it was like, knowing the amount of the homeless population, it could possibly have been an explosion. You know, it was just, they gave us only one side of the street. He only wanted one side of the street. They didn't want this block. They didn't want that block. They didn't want this block because trucks back out. You know, a whole block away, trucks back out. Back out, and mm-hmm. they took that away and took that away. Emily Riley came in with, it has to be mandatory registration of all sleepers. If you sleep in these safe zones, you have to register in advance. Mm-hmm. It made it completely unworkable. And then the last betrayal was when I came out of the negotiations for these safe sleeping zones, I only made a very few demands. I gave in to everything they wanted because my bottom line was decriminalization of sleep.
Plus, we should add,
David,
just a second.
Yeah.
We should also say that they suddenly introduced CEQA concerns because they thought they were going to be sued.
Yeah, the city attorney had the CEQA concerns, so they... So
and what are CEQA concerns? Can you tell us briefly?
Environmental impact on the area.
Right.
Now, when you have a working group working on mitigation efforts on that very fact, you're not liable to CEQA a lawsuit. You're actually ahead of the CEQA lawsuit. Mm-hmm. So it was a bunch of bullshit. And for them to say that they're therefore going to break their promise and not put it on the agenda, I knew if they didn't vote the second reading in 2 weeks that the whole thing would start going down the tubes. And when I saw the way that they were designing it, where they were trying to make it so that it was explosive, when I heard the stories of the sheriff sending the police from the North Coast into the zones, when I heard the stories of the police sending people into the zones, when I heard the stories of people dropping off that couch out there, when I heard the stories from the homeless people that were out there already early, they weren't supposed to be there before July 14th, they were already out there, you know, after June 14th.
And they weren't told by police not to go, they weren't told by police to go.
Actually, they were told by police to go, and we're not to open that until July 14th or until it was ready.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was told by those homeless people out there that in the middle of the night, people that were not sleeping out there were coming out there and in a kamikaze fashion, dumping trash in the middle of the lots near where they were sleeping and then leaving. I knew there was sabotage going on. I knew there was major sabotage going on, and the police were involved on it. And when you look at the June 13th oral communications videotape at the library, you hear neighbor after neighbor after neighbor after neighbor after neighbor after neighbor in those areas telling the city council that the police told them that the camping ban was completely repealed, that the council told the police that they could not enforce any drug laws, they could not enforce any nuisance laws, they could not enforce any sanitation laws. That is misrepresentations of the council by police. That's police acting as political agents. That to me is a serious constitutional crime. Mm-hmm. that's gone on. Now, so the police are out of control as far as I'm concerned. After hearing of how the police beat up a 14-year-old mentally ill girl last week down in Lower Ocean, and the way that they did, dropped their knee on her head several times over and over for a 14-year-old girl, the way they treated her, beating her up. Calling it resisting arrest and then and making charges of her assaulting an officer. You know, there's got to be a cleanup of this police department. We got to do it soon, or else we're all in trouble.
I hear you.
And my lawsuit will be following soon, and my complaints will be coming soon. I've been very unwell, as you know.
Sure.
And I do have to file some complaints.
Well, let me ask a couple, kind of make a couple points here, and get your reaction, David. Have you been listening to the show?
I have only listened to part of it because I'm sort of in between. I've got to get over to the fair.
Okay. Well, then very briefly before you go.
Sure. Can I listen to it on the radio?
Sure, although, yeah, you can if you want.
Okay, bye.
No problem.
And there is the man who, as I said, I've filed a new Brown Act complaint about his exclusion from the council chambers on June 11th, or is it, maybe it's June 13th. I think it was June 13th, actually, was that council meeting. And that was through the very, very draconian measure of an arrest. Now, of course, the background of that is, after all this sabotaging of efforts by the different staff agencies, whether it's police, I guess, and other people, I think Sugar's failure to bring this issue back to city council in a timely manner, and Crone's failure, and Fitzmaurice's failure, they all failed, and never apologized for it, and have never asked for any investigation of police misconduct, by the way, I'd like to add. And I would like to see the Green Party censuring Tim Fitzmaurice for that alone and for his entire history around the sleeping ban, because he's the only Green Party candidate on the council, and he needs to be held accountable. Of course, the SCAN candidates, they're all SCAN candidates. They all need to be held accountable. But in any case, the issue came back to city council. We actually have another call. I think David may be calling in again to comment on some of my characterizations. Hang on.
Hi there.
Yeah, on what basis would you hold the Green Party and SCAN accountable? Isn't that the reason why one becomes a member of SCAN or the Green Party is to not be accountable?
You dog, you. Well, what we've tried to do, we've raised at the SCAN and the Green Party. I am a member of SCAN, I would like to shamefacedly admit. I actually ponied up $5, I think it was, for the in order to be present at the steering committee, so they didn't completely sabotage the Dolphin Forum, and that I think was successful, and I think I was able to do that. But what I think needs to be done is candidates need to acknowledge that they will do something like they will agree to resign if 75% of the membership finds them, let's say 6 months later, they've not fulfilled their promises or they've voted against it. And they have to sign such a pledge. I was going to even suggest, for example, around the sleeping van, that people put $2,000 in an escrow account, and if they don't follow their promises on that, that money goes immediately to a lawsuit to help end the sleeping van.
Well, I guess I would. What's the purpose of a political party, untainted by implementation or otherwise? It's to create a double standard.
It's to get those people elected. You know, I mean, it's
exactly right. You're saying it. It's about we. It's about power. It's about looking the other way when it's in one's own camp, rather than the more obvious and sincere. What's the issue? Who's the candidate? You want to nail some candidate for something, not because they're a green. My opinion, Robert, not because they're a green or they're scanned. It's in spite of the fact that they're a green or they're with scan. First thing I think about when I think about the Greens or a scan or anything else like that is that it's a scam, and it proves itself in practice.
Well, of course, the theory is that people are coming together to try to push issues on an agenda which should be pushed but which are not being pushed. And
it's so broad-based that it becomes a goon squad. It becomes a party whips. The whole idea of, you know, what is a party whip? It's someone that goes around and says, you're a Democrat, you got to vote this way.
Right. Well, of course, there are no party whips. You're talking about people who are actually in the legislature.
Right.
We don't actually have those kind of people who are doing that.
You ever received a call from a boiler room from a party about how we're all going to vote this way? Do you ever wonder if the person that's making that boiler room call actually believes what they're saying? Or they're just saying it because they're a party member?
Well, I think you got to hold candidates accountable, whether it's to a party or to the public generally. And I think that that's what I'd like to see happen in this election, that when candidates say something, that sounds very nice, but we want you to have some consequence if you don't do it. You know, I mean, that's pretty obvious. A scan should be condemning these people. So should the Greens around at least the sleeping ban on the Dolphin. Fitzmaurice has been horrible around
Even the Greens, as untainted by implementation as they are, if and when they ever get power, in my opinion...
Fitzmaurice has been in power for 2 years.
And what does it show?
What?
Where's the bandwagon? What it shows is it's just another way to deflect away from the integrity of the individual. This is where I'm at.
To me,
I see this, and maybe it appears more insidious on the so-called left because things appear more hopeless when the left shows itself to be as corrupt tactically and willing to justify. And there are things that have gone down under Clinton that could have never gone down under a Republican administration.
I said that LBJ did the war in Vietnam and Goldwater could never have done it. But, yeah, I appreciate that. Is there more you want to add?
That's about it. The Columbia, the payoffs to Columbia.
Oh,
this is shameful stuff.
It is. Although I don't know that Bush wouldn't have done the same thing or, you know, whoever it was, what's his name?
Money. You bet. Robert, thank you for letting me make
sure.
I believe these are important comments. What's the issue? Who's the candidate? Is the reality? The rest of it is escapism, denial.
Thank you.
And the original reason that David Silva was dragged off to the Nut Ward was because he talked about immolating himself at city council in an angry manner on, I guess, Keith Sugar's answering machine, and he also made such statements publicly. But the day after he said those things, he explained that he had thought better of the issue, or he had changed his mind on that, and it was not a serious political threat. You know, if it were a political threat, by the way, he shouldn't have been dragged off to the Nut Ward. He should have been held accountable by some sort of legal requirement of disturbing the peace. David Silva in no way disturbed the peace in the June 13th City Council meeting. We have a call.
Hi there.
Hi, Robert. This is Eleanor.
Hi, Eleanor. The author of the September 11th brief.
Thank you, but I really want to call in because... I had a particular favorite that we put in the points and authorities, and that was the California Code 11120, Public Policy, Legislative Finding and Declaration Citation of Article. I won't read the whole thing to you. It's very brief, though, but basically what it says is that the people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. The people, in delegating authority, do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. There's a little more here, but that was one of my favorites on top of the amendment violations, First Amendment and the Brown Act. This one I like because it's very brief, and it addresses the core of the problem here. They've forgotten that Santa Cruz is in the United States of America. I like Keith Sugar, I really do, but I believe that when he got into office, he forgot, and he's following the wrong people in there. And I really do pray that he use this as an opportunity to break away from maintaining this policy that they've created to keep people in the city that they choose to keep down for various reasons, and to not allow the people to be informed. Because, let's face it, he can't be everywhere. The elected official only knows what's going on by what he hears from the people. He doesn't know everything that's going on. The people tell him. And if he's not listening, then it can't be changed, because he's there and he's the one. And so I'm really very, very happy that you filed this, because I think it should be a wake-up call. And I pray, if it's not, of course, the law, you know, the courts will take care of it, and that's why you did it. It reminds me, and I don't really mean to make light of this, because this is really serious. It reminds me of the scene in the Woody Allen movie Bananas. I'm dating myself now. There was a courtroom scene. It was a mockery of justice. It wasn't in America. It was in some third world nation, I guess. But it was a mockery of justice, where he was captured and he was called to take the stand to speak on his behalf, and they had him bound and gagged. And he's busily trying to talk, and all you hear is the mumbling. That's what was done to you.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually about to play that tape now.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And there's one other thing I want to add to this, if I may. This brings me to the Mercy's housing system, which is one of the main problems here, the core of why you did this. One was the sleeping ban, the alternatives for people who don't have a place to sleep, and to not criminalize them. But the other was what's going on with Mercy.
Mercy Charities Housing.
Mercy Charity, Mercy, well, they call themselves Mercy Housing System once you start giving them your money.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, they're a subsidiary of Mercy Charities. They don't do things right. And if we allow it to go on the way they were attempting to do at that June 27th meeting, where they totally silenced you, then these people, the Mercy people, will be allowed to unimpeded continue the violations of the rights of individuals that they're doing, in particular the disabled and the seniors. This is just the tip of the iceberg, but they suffer the most. I'm one of them, I know. Their policies, their practices, their procedures, they will not bend from what they think is right, and they're wrong.
Do the tenants have any input? I know you, should we say where you live, or is that...
It's okay, yeah.
You live in the Sycamore Commons.
Yes.
And you are disabled, you're in a wheelchair.
Yes.
And you've been having particular problems in terms of just placement of people above you and the noise and
Well, such. The problem here is that they designed Mercy, they designed Sycamore Commons. The design, and then they back it up with policies, is discriminatory toward disabled, in that the only place you can live here if you're disabled is underneath families and across from a very noisy daycare developmental center yard, which goes all day long with children outside screaming and yelling. And the noise decibel levels are harmful to those people who have disabilities or who are aged. I think even normal people too, but when you're disabled, these things really harm you even more. And they don't provide for the disabled person to have the equal enjoyment of the properties as they do the non-disabled. They have the only people who are in this situation with children over them, families over their bedrooms and families over their bathrooms and living rooms, and children opposite them from 7:30 in the morning till 5:30 at night. Only the disabled have this.
Now, you're not suggesting that children should be barred from this housing development.
Well, I'm suggesting at this point what I've recommended and was totally flatly denied in a letter the other day I received. And I went through all the channels of the HUD reasonable accommodations requests and verifications of efficacy from my doctors and everything else. I went through all of this. What I'm suggesting is that you don't discriminate against a disabled person. You don't throw them in the worst of the situation and give those who aren't disabled the better of the situation, because, I don't know, whatever their reasoning, they don't like you any longer. They want the money to construct the unit, but they don't want to do what comes with the money, which is follow the guidelines. They have people in and I'm one of them, in an apartment that I can't get in and out of. I have to have someone get me in and out, and the way they have to do it harms my condition. You can't turn in here. It's not wheelchair accessible. You've got another guy in here 2 years with a rug that shouldn't have been there, banging into it, causing spasm, telling them it's that he's got to pay for it because it's not a reasonable accommodation when they took him up for me before I moved in, you know. They're not quitting. They just make up their own rules, and they think that, just like our city council, that they're not in America, that somehow or other they're somewhere else here, and they don't have to, or they're special, and they don't have to abide by the rules, the laws that are in place. And to answer your question specifically,
they are special because the city council has them as the only person that they funnel their low-income housing money to.
That's why one of the reasons why your petition for a writ of mandamus to go before a judge on this is important, because the city council cannot decide for the people.
Now, you were saying something else when I interrupted you. Did you want to finish that thought?
Well, I just want to answer your question directly. Am I saying that they're not affording me, or they're telling me that children have to be away from me? Yes, I am. They're not affording me, and yes, I am saying that if you have a structure, and it all boils down to two things, structure and traffic. If you have a structure that can't handle this noise, you should not put a dozen people over a disabled person. You should not place them in a unit that can't handle this noise and this traffic and vibrations and shaking, and that's what they've done. And yes, we do have a law that says that your policies and practice cannot discriminate against a disabled person. And yes, we have in place since 1992, and people tried to challenge this in 88, and it was overturned in 92. Yes, you can separate disabled people to a certain extent by medical necessity from children and families. They bring more noise, they bring more activity, they bring more traffic. And they should be allowed to have their traffic and their noise and their activity. They have a right. They're children. They're growing. And the families have a right to allow their children to play as they see fit. But if you stick that and put a disabled person in the middle of this, where they're over them, around them, in front of them, what are you doing to that person? I mean, it's shocking. The person who lived in this apartment before me, Catherine Byers personally helped this disabled veteran who's in a wheelchair get in here because they were barring him. They were not following the guidelines and letting disabled people in. Catherine Byers got him in. What did they do with him once they got him in? They put him in here in this unit. The man was alone. He didn't have the benefit of a live-in attendant like I do. I have a healthy, normal, able-bodied live-in attendant who can help me defend myself. This man didn't have it. They drove him insane. He's now on the street. He fled for his life. Mercy Housing paid him off, but they didn't pay him what he should have gotten, and he's homeless. And they're doing it to me, only I'm holding tough. And I'm going to follow in the footsteps of you, Mr. Norse, who has shown me, file the petitions, take it to court.
Wow, you know, I have to turn that around and say, there would be no petition filed on September 11th had you not written it, Eleanor.
I know, but I couldn't have written if you didn't have the will to want it done. I had to wait for you to have the will. And the other people who came together, it wasn't done alone. I had an enormous amount of support. I could not have done this if it weren't for at least four or five people, including you, Becky Johnson, Robert, Ed Fry, the people down at the courthouse who were very helpful to me, the people in the law library who got the books and lifted them and opened them for me. The people of Santa Cruz got together for you. It wasn't just me. And I thank you for being up there and standing up for yourself. I gotta go.
Hey.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, if you listen to that presentation by Eleanor describing her situation, you can understand the kind of language that's in this petition, how eloquent it is. And I think, you know, if there is any justice in Santa Cruz, and that's, of course, an open question, there will be some response by the courts.
Hi, you're on the air with Free Radio.
Yeah, Domini, we're all Catholic here in Santa Cruz.
Oh, well, tell me more.
That Mercy Charities Housing is the sole service provider for affordable housing. And then, of course, Catholic Healthcare West has pretty much got the market cornered on medical care with the Dominican Hospital complex. and the profoundly anti-choice policies of Dominican Hospital as well. But that's not what I called about.
I should interject that there has been no clear finding that Mercy Charities in any way contributes money to the Catholic Healthcare West, or the Catholic Healthcare West controls Mercy Charities, as far as I know.
Well, they are sponsored by...
They both share the sponsor of the Sisters of Mercy, it's true.
Right, and were initially set up by them, and presumably, and do have some of the same people on board of directors as both organizations.
I just want to be very clear about that, because I think if you're claiming that there is some religious involvement here, you have to be very, very careful and very, very specific. I was...
Mm-hmm. Well, it may not be legally, but there's certainly a psychological involvement and a commitment on the part of people who are
My concerns about Mercy Charities don't really involve the religious angle. They involve the fact that Mercy Charities does not use a public process. And I was going to ask Eleanor on the call, and I've heard the question answered before, whether they allow any tenant input, whether there's real tenant involvement in the policies of their group, of their building. And as far as I know, there is not.
I've not heard that there is much, and I'm also, looking to see what, if any, exists.
Well, we're talking to
tenant involvement.
We're talking to Becky Johnson, and you have actually written at least three articles on Mercy Charities Housing's involvement in the Beach Flats Dolphin Lee project, and so you have done some research on the subject.
Yeah, I have, and I have my concerns about Mercy Charities Housing as a management company, which the city has given the exclusive authority. They're very strict, their rules, their criteria. Criteria for eligibility has come up as an issue. And generally, it's even though it's for low-income and even very low-income people, they still have to have a decent credit rating, no past history of unlawful detainers. They look at your criminal history, which an attorney friend of mine says may not even be legal to do that, since when you're punished for a crime, you're only supposed to get the punishment that the court awards. There's not supposed to be additional punishments enacted by society.
We actually heard false...
Denying housing would be an additional punishment.
We actually heard false information from Mayor Sugar on that issue. One of the few times he went down and talked to Residente Unidos, the Dolphin Lee tenant group, in, I guess, late May and early June. It was actually in June, when he claimed that Mercy had to have these felony restrictions if you've been convicted of a felony, or even, mm-hmm. let's say, not necessarily for the last 5 years, as they have had, but let's say after a certain cutoff point, they want to examine if you've convicted of a felony, you can't come into the housing after a certain date. Sugar claimed that this was required by state law or by the funding sources that Mercy Charities relied on, because Mercy Charities was providing low-income housing to people, in essence, subsidized housing. And what we found out from Mercy Charities, as I remember, and I think you were at that meeting, was that this is not a choice based on funding requirements. This is a choice based on Mercy Charities' belief that they want to have a, quote, clean and, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, legal, above-board, no scummy characters housing.
No riffraff.
No riffraff, right.
Housing.
And that's... So it really isn't the requirement of the... Now, I don't see...
And often poor people have credit problems, or they have unlawful detainers in their history.
Well, I'm talking about the felony requirement specifically, and I guess, we don't really have...
Well, no, this was my take on this, Robert, about the felony requirement.
Yeah.
That if Mercy Charities adopted a don't ask, don't tell policy, they don't ask if they have felony convictions, and people don't volunteer it, then... The Mercy and the city is off the hook in terms of lawsuits.
I remember that suggestion you made, Becky, and I also remember Mercy's later saying there were no legal requirements anyway, so it wouldn't make any difference. The problem we have here is we have a series of assertions from people, and we haven't got the law in front of us. And I'm hoping that at the October 28th forum, the forum on the Dolphin being held by the SCAN Housing and Homelessness Committee and Community Television, I guess, from 1 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon?
That's correct. Correct, October 28th, Channel 27.
That at that particular forum, indeed for a couple weeks beforehand with some documents posted on the web, we can have a really meaningful discussion based on what the real law is, not based on what sugar tells us or we can kind of try to counterpose to that, but what the actual legal documents say, what the real court decisions say. That's something that has not been done around this issue, and the scan mandate had been done back on May 31st when it said don't evict the Dolphin tenants and the Lee tenants without having real guarantees, and we have to find out what those real guarantees are. Can they guarantee that people can come back in? Are they restricted by federal law? These are the questions we hope to answer on October 28th between 1 and 4 on community television.
And I hope people will watch that, and 2 hours of that will be live, so there will be a chance for people to call in and ask questions of the experts and the city council candidates as well directly. But I wanted to get to the whole reason I called had to do with the David Silva detention, arrest,
kidnapping
mm-hmm. at city council.
Though he's no kid, I'll tell you that.
Right. The following city council meeting at Oral Communications, Lydia Blanchard, who is a licensed psychotherapist locally, commented on what had happened to David, and she said that when he made the phone call on Thursday night, allegedly to Keith Sugar's answering machine, where he allegedly said, "What is it going to take to get you guys to do something about this sleeping ban? Do I have to set myself on fire at city council chambers?" Which could be perceived as a death threat. I don't know, it sounded like an extreme statement.
As I said, I mean, there have been Buddhists.
Let me finish my point. She said that if that was indeed a true suicide, that person was considering suicide, that all the psychotherapy says that you should have to act within 48 hours. That's if you're going to act on that. That's the window to act.
So, in fact, when Sugar ordered him to be arrested and taken away, that was, and that was done like 5 days later at the Tuesday council meeting.
I understand that it was not called in on Friday, the day after, and mm-hmm. apologized.
It was not an action that was merited by a genuine concern about either David's mental health on this issue. So, but what I was interrupting you about and what I wanted to say was, is repeat what I said before, which is that if someone is threatening to immolate themselves, you know, this is not a traditional American method, though it has been done during the Vietnam War, and of course, over in Vietnam, it was done by a number of Buddhist monks in protest against the Diem government. It's not that it shows you're mentally unsound. It may show that you are politically committed to a very, very serious course of action.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to cause violence against other people. Instead, you are going to dramatize the depth of your conviction by doing this. And as such, I suppose it could be regarded as criminal if it's done in a fashion that jeopardizes other people, or I guess insofar as suicide is a crime. I think in some statute books it is, mm-hmm. but it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with mental illness. And so I was suggesting that even, you know, let's suppose that Sugar had, he wasn't doing it because of the mental illness thing, because he obviously wasn't. If he were really concerned that David was mentally ill, he would have acted within 48 hours of the threat. No, he wasn't.
Any experts that Keith Sugar would have consulted.
Right, right. No, we agree with that.
Have they been?
Right, we agree with that, Becky.
Standard operating procedure.
We agree with that. We agree with that. But what?
48 hours.
Right, we agree with that. What I'm saying is that had he a concern about violations of the law or legitimate violations of the public order, he would have had to file a charge about that. And that would have, of course, laid him open to a false arrest charge. Sugar didn't do that either. Instead, he used this, you know, his control of the police as mayor, as he used it before to target James Ney, as he used it after to target me, targeted James Ney on April, I believe it was April 11th, targeted me on July 25th, had me arrested, had Ney arrested. Again, no charges in either case.
Mm-hmm.
No paper trail. Nothing there. If you want to deal with it, you have to file a lawsuit later. And that, you know, none of us have done that yet, though David Silva is talking about it. The lawsuit I'm filing is a sort of a different sort, and it's really about violation of public process.
Mm-hmm.
Not just, I mean, obviously it violates my personal rights to be arrested, but more important, it violates the public right to be able to hear from those of us who are trying to discuss issues, and it intimidates other people in the public arena who would want to raise those issues.
It is very intimidating when you're speaking at the mic and you know that there are police officers standing nearby, police officers who have grabbed and arrested people under very similar circumstances, numerous times in the past, and then have your speech interrupted repeatedly by various council members. It's very intimidating.
And the question really, I think, now is where do we go from here? And I'm wondering, we've talked to some of the council candidates, and you were at this homeless working group meeting. I'm going to kind of shift back perhaps to the issues that were raised at this homeless working group, which meets every Friday from 3 to 5 at the Holiday Inn, to which the public is invited. And there will be, I guess, hopefully 6 more candidates, the last 6 in alphabetical order, next Friday. You've been to 2 of these candidate forums, and you've heard, I guess, 8 candidates, including Arnie Leff, Scott Kennedy, Bonnie Moore, Dick DeBrava, Martin Bryan, Steve Argue, and Peter Cook, all speaking on at least some of the issues. I know we kind of focused initially on the sleeping ban, and then we broadened at the last meeting to talk about community control of police and rent control and tenant rights. But before we get into any of that, do you have any sense, I didn't hear from any of the candidates, any concerns about city council process or about the kind of really terror that we saw in Los Angeles with massive police on the street, but is also here in Santa Cruz, kind of lurking under the covers. You know, it's at city council because the mayor can call in his goon squads. And I'm just, did you sense that this is going to be an issue at all in this election?
Almost the opposite. I mean, at the Mark Premack campaign kickoff I was at yesterday, now this wasn't, from the homeless working group, and hopefully Mark will be coming to the next Friday session, but he was saying about the city council process that we just absolutely can't have this sort of crazy